Killer Keller podcast. KillerKellerOfficial.com.
You need the Kellervision app. 24/7 mini documentaries, podcasts, live shows, DJ live streams, top fives, subscription packages, plus products for all your podcasts and street culture sports. Download it from the App Store for free today.
Instagram UK Frontline.
Beatbox created.
Killer Keller.
And we're here to talk about world music and street culture.
Killer Keller podcast.
Yo, it don't get better than this. Especially unprecedented. I did well. We were set, but for fuck's sake, I'm very excited you're here. Ladies and gentlemen, Killer Keller podcast live and direct. Central London, or central as you need to be. Share and care that, yeah? Pass the word around. Spread it. Spread it. Big up graffitikings.co.uk. Hold tight, everyone, with the Kellervision app. Getting involved. Lots of new things on the way, that's for sure. Hold true to that, we do have a gentleman that's inside the place. Hey. Legendary in the early 80s graffiti, moving on swiftly into a music career that we're going to dive into. On equal measure, the legends, the people that create the street culture that we absorb and take in like it was regular content online. This is one of the men that was doing it from the jump. It goes by the name of Coma. What are you saying, my brother?
Nice to meet you, Keller.
It's hard to put you into put it into context when you think about the way the world is now to how it first began with the world of street culture, huh?
Yeah, I mean, things are a lot different now than when we were doing graph, I guess. But it's good that people are still interested in the history. So that's why I'm here, I guess.
Super excited you're here, brother. Like, The fault lines, again, like, big shout out to everybody from back in the day. There's a lot of youngsters that are here as well. And it's just super important that we get deep into this sort of conversation. And also the music side of what you're about. Like,
right, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, a lot of people, graffiti is the conduit, the first entry point into what becomes their creative path.
Exactly. I mean, the thing with graffiti, it gives you this kind of do-it-yourself. You know, like punk or hip hop, I guess. It's like I don't need anyone else. I can go and create myself
and
do it on my own terms and that independence. And I carried that along, that attitude from graph into the music. I guess with hardcore and drum and bass and those guys, they had the same, it's the same ethos of having, doing everything yourself, starting your own label, no bullshit from the majors, no answering to anyone.
Yeah.
Just putting your shit out there on your own terms kind of thing. And that attitude, I think, I got from graph.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hip-hop came as like a super package, wasn't it? It was like one of those... Beforehand, there was that, the punk thing. But hip-hop allowed that cheap to enter kind of attitude of like, oh, they're doing it, we can do it. Like, really, we can do it.
I guess so. I guess we looked at what was happening with what came before, because with the UK, with London anyway, there was a punk influence to the graph. So like the Clash, the Clash brought Futura over, and he did the first piece in Grove.
And big up Scam as well at that point as well, because
big
he
up
was
Scam. Link, I think he had a tag on there.
Yeah.
But before that, Ladbroke Grove had this history of like anarchists and counterculture, and there was this group of anarchists called King Mob. So it wasn't hip hop. They used to, on the track sides, they do graph along the track sides.
What?
So it was more like political and social and really anarchistic. And there's a book called The Writing on the Wall about 70s graph in the UK, in London.
I know of this, yeah. I'm aware of this.
And the King Mob, they wrote, I think it was under the Westway, on the little Met line, all along the track side, saying work, eat, sleep, work, eat, sleep, that kind of, you're in a rat race kind of thing.
Observational kind of graph sort of thing.
So Grove has got a history of graph before hip-hop, and that kind of, and it was just coincidental that Futura The Clash were from Grove.
Mm.
And then they got Futura. They brought Futura over on tour with them, and he did that piece there.
Mind-blowing.
And then that became the mecca for a lot of writers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Under the Westway. So the punk, there is a punk connection.
There is. And also there's, especially with Grove as well, and this is something that we kind of brought up with Scam's podcast, It was almost like the Young Turks. It was almost like the new hipsters. They were there, and there was bands like Motorhead was
Hawkwind,
was Hawkwind, yeah. Things like that, which I've always found like endearing. It was almost like what Old Street is now, I guess.
It was bohemian.
Bohemian.
Yeah, yeah. It was this place where it was kind of arty and edgy, but it wasn't moneyed. It was still a slum, like. Some part, I mean, Scam used to tell me how Power Square used to
Power
be
Square,
like rough.
Yeah.
And like the front line, All Saints Road, even when we were doing Graff, it was a no-go area.
Really?
Kind of thing. Yeah.
Talk to me about that. So what was it like?
I never even ventured down there. But I had family in Bayswater, the posh, like the rich bit.
Right, right. So we had an embassy back over elsewhere.
But my gran moved to Bayswater in the 60s, and so it wasn't particularly rich. She rented a place there, so it was like a family home. We used to go at the weekends, and so then I'd wander down to Ladbroke Grove, and that's how I got to meet the Grove lot, because I grew up in Wembley originally.
North Wheezy, hold tight, North Wheezy crew, you know it is.
But we didn't. I mean, there were gangs. There was a gang called Tape Tone who used to trouble the writers and rob the writers.
What, that weren't into Graff like that? They were just troubling them?
They were just a part of a bigger gang. I'm not sure. I thought they might be related to a sound system or something. But people like the real Grove lot, like Scam and Hate and Foam, they would know more about that. I was kind of part-time Grove, I think. And Tape Tone... I mean, I got robbed by Tape Tone. Hate did. I think Foam did.
Really?
But they were. I think they thought of writers as just idiots, and they were. I think they went on to be like proper, serious criminals.
Really?
But that it was a bit edgy and a bit dangerous. Some parts and some parts I wouldn't go down All Saints Road or anything like that.
You know what's interesting about the, and this is only through conversations that I've had, I wasn't there, you understand, you know, I'm speaking through God knows how many episodes, but I do feel like there was, when imported in, hip-hop was such a culture shock.
They just thought, oh, these guys are just idiots.
Really?
Like, well, they're just running around painting their name everywhere.
Really?
They're not doing, what's the point of that kind of thing?
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, it is true. It's quite a self-serving art form, isn't graffiti? It's quite self-serving in a way.
Yeah. There's no money, there's no reward, financial reward.
Yeah.
It's like you're just doing this for some kind of outlet, creative outlet.
Yeah, yeah.
But So I mean, when hip hop came here, I think it identified with a lot of people from all different backgrounds. It was like a craze, a massive movement that came over in the 80s. The videos, like the books, Subway Art, Style Wars.
Here, have all of this. Now go and do it. Right? Yeah, pretty much, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think people who like from all different nationalities and ethnic backgrounds, identified with it, which is not like other youth cultures before.
No.
Really, it brought different people together. Like writers, they were from all. You had really rich writers. You had people from the roughest housing estates and everyone in between kind of thing.
Yeah.
So there was nothing, no other youth movement like that. That was just so diverse and different racial backgrounds.
Yeah.
Black, white, Indian, Chinese, all together.
It's funny, I measure a lot of my movements on that. And the thing is with Graff, like you say, it's all about the tenacity. Bring it. How far can you get up? It don't matter. We don't even want to see your face. We want to see you up.
That's it. It was about have you got the skills?
Yeah.
Or are you all city, can you bomb and can you peace kind of thing?
Yeah.
I guess they call it a meritocracy.
A meritocracy.
The talent, the real talent does rise to the top.
Oh,
and
God, you've just given me a new word. You watch this.
Meritocracy.
It's going to be on all the podcasts moving forward now. Meritocracy, you see, you are. It's wicked. Does it blow your mind, the idea of starting so young in the game? And bear in mind, we're only talking about like what between 84 and 86?
Well, no, I started doing outlines and stuff in about 84, but probably 85 when I actually first went out there and did pieces. The first train was in 1985, and then I stopped in 1988, my last train.
Last train in 88?
88 with Hate, yeah.
It's bonkers when you think about it.
And I might have done it. I did a few little record covers and stuff after that, but nothing illegal. Hmm. Because I mean, I've probably said this on other things, but I got sent... me and Tilt were the first to get sent to prison for it in 86. Mm-hmm. And then we got done again, a whole load of us in... we got arrested in 88, but the court case didn't come up till 1989. And by that time, I'd stopped. But, yeah, that's a whole other story about getting into the acid house and music taking over.
Mm. Oh, we'll get into that.
I got into Graf by going to New York as well. So I went to New York in 85.
Right.
With my brother, because I had family over there. I saw the tail end of it. I saw the graffiti on the trains. I saw pieces by a guy called Cast, not the cast here.
No, yeah.
Doze, wow. And a few others. And I saw quick throw ups and scene throw ups.
In the flesh.
In the flesh. Like scene and PJ along the highway, along the motorway from the airport into the city.
Oh, I know the one. I think it's... Oh, I could be wrong about it. Rock Creek Park, mate.
As you're coming
in, you'll sit... Because I did that trip and I saw these things on the side.
Yeah.
You kind of feel like you're going into... driving into the projects like that, right?
Yeah. And then a Zephyr tag. Mm. So I witnessed the end of it. And then we went to the Fresh Festival. So it was like a hip-hop jam in Queens, I think. And it was LL Cool J was the first one on. No one had heard of him. Or he'd just done the first album or something. And then Houdini, Fat Boys, and then Run DMC headlined.
And all in their prime.
Yeah, this was that peak. Yeah.
What was the audience like?
It was...
bonkers.
I guess it was pretty much mainly a black audience from whatever, from New York. Yeah, yeah. New York black
but
audience.
Packed out.
Packed, yeah, mad. Yeah. Like, I don't know, thousands of people.
It's so hard to comprehend because it's just a given, isn't it? And it's just a given that hip-hop is the way it is now.
Yeah, but this was the beginning. So when you go through something like that at that age, you came back here and it's like, well, I've got to carry that on somehow.
yeah, exactly. I bought my hip-hop clobber. I've got at least whole tree. It's funny.
Yeah, I did buy all the clobber as well. Yeah. Like name belts, like Puma joints, the suede Pumas with fat laces, two-tone jeans. Yeah.
Must have been like night and day you leaving and coming back.
it was kind of at the same time over here was just after electro. So... hip-hop was kind of... the music was getting big. Mm. We just, like, the Graf people were just starting to get into Graf. So, yeah, it was the beginnings, really, here.
Yeah, and like we were saying just prior to this, it's almost like such a small, condensed time. You were absolutely kinging it in every sense. You were actually, you know, I don't know, like Criminal Damage, Set Free, Foam, Hate, like you say. I mean, the list goes on, like... Hit and Run, like these were kind of like era-defining artists that you were kind of mixing and matching with.
Well, yeah, but we didn't realise that at the time. It was just the beginning and it was just a movement that had never happened before. And a lot of people in London were into it. There were a lot of writers.
Was it like a kind of influx where there'd be just everyone would have a tag, everyone would have a name?
Well, not everyone, but probably more than there's ever been, I think.
Yeah.
Hundreds, maybe thousands, I don't know.
It's like a phase.
From all over London.
Really?
We're just writing, yeah. And it, no one would, no one at the time, you're not going to think this is something cool and unique. But when looking back on it,
it's cool.
It was
and
like
unique.
The beginnings of a youth culture that didn't exist over here before.
Yeah.
So,
and
yeah.
It's often the biggest question I think people pose from the outside looking in is, why would you do something that you don't make money off of and is dangerous? And but that's like the purest form of art.
Well, that's
itself.
It. It's like yeah. you're risking your life and your freedom for something that's not making any money. But at that age, it was about the buzz.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the fun, the buzz of it. And for some people like me, it was like an alternative family or a way of getting identity, validation from peers that you need that you weren't getting, kind of thing.
Mm.
So you wouldn't, yeah. I mean, a lot of writers I know, a lot of the Grove writers were from fucked up households or one parent families and stuff
right.
like that. But then again, the people from Harrow were a bit more suburban, but they were just as hardcore.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So like, yeah. It was a real variety. I don't know. I think it was just a trend. And as teens, you're just going along with what all your other teen friends are doing. It just all came together, I guess.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And I can't believe that it's still going now. I mean, I see trains are still being done.
Trust me.
Yeah.
Trust me. And you were saying at the start, like the moment you stopped. Actually, let's not go here just yet, because
okay.
I kind of want to touch on a few extra subjects. The fan in me is coming out, guys, as I'm sure it is with you. Give me examples of when you were out, for instance, with Tilt or Foam, or you know, some of those classic pieces, kind of those classic moments. Because I'm asking you this because most of the time, again, it's just a given. But you were learning as you kind of went. There was elements of like this had never. So talk to me about those. That process back in the
one, day. The one kind of famous thing I remember was when we went to Rickmansworth Yard for the first time. So there was Tilt cast. I can't remember who else. There was a guy called Mac one, and another guy called Jest from Harrow. But there must have been about 10 of us, but I can't remember the other guys.
10 of you?
Yeah.
That shit sounds scary, bro. Like, I know Excel mentioned this, that you guys just all rolled in like you like firm. Like you were in a firm.
But we thought the trains parked up at Watford. We were just learning. So we got the last train to Watford and then got off, got out of the station, waited around. It's what you do.
Mm.
And then kind of looked at the sidings or the layups.
Mm.
No trains.
Yeah.
They didn't park them up there. So what we had to do, we had to get back onto the lines. We walked all the way down the lines, and there's a junction where it goes off going towards Rickmansworth.
Right.
And we knew there was a yard in Rickmansworth. Chrome Angels, I think, did Rickmansworth the first, but I'm not sure who'd been there before. Mm. I don't think any of us had actually been there before. So we all walk down the lines, and there was a hut just before you get to the yard, a workman's hut. And so in order to kill some times, we couldn't get in there till about one or two because there'd be cleaners, workmen.
Yeah, yeah.
So we'd wait in the hut. So, and I think Tilt had some music and some speed as well. I didn't take any speed, but we were kind of listening to music in the yard, in this workman's hut before we went in. Then we went in Rickmansworth. It was fine. There was no one in there. There was about five trains all parked up. This guy, Mac, there was a light flashing just on and off. And Mac was like, yo, Tilt, I've timed the light and it's going on and off every 5 seconds. Tilt just looked at him and goes, shut up, you plonker.
Speed talking
yeah,
there.
Yeah, yeah, what are you on about? And so it was fine. We just painted it, all did our pieces. I haven't got any pictures of it. I don't think anyone. No one took photos there and then that much back then. You'd have to carry a camera.
Yeah, yeah. I guess it's just another thing that you don't need
to carry. Yeah. So most people didn't take photos in the yards.
What was it like when? Because you weren't. Obviously, the paint compared to now back then was a whole lot different as well. What was the cans? What were the weapons?
I mean, the best paint was Bunt Lack, obviously.
Of course, yeah.
but it was the hardest to get. By chance, there was an industrial estate where I lived, around the corner in Wembley, and there was an art kind of shop there, and they had Buntlack in there. So there was Buntlack round the corner from where I lived. So I used to go in there, pretend I was some art student with a portfolio, load it up with Buntlacks, and that way. But then my mate Reem, who I used to paint with, he went in there and we hotted it up.
Hotted basically. Up, yeah, you went in too hard.
So it didn't last long. But Buntlack was obviously the best paint. Always used Hammerite Black for outlines. Mm-hmm. I think because the way it came out and the thickness of it, and it stained, it always stained the train quite hard.
So even after, it's still...
Yeah, so when they buff it, it still shows through.
I love that look, though. I do love that
The buff look.
Yeah, I love the buff look as well. There's something about it, just knowing that the scent's still there, you know, when seeing it.
Yeah, ghosts.
Yeah, they're ghosts. Like ghosts. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Hammerite White for outline. There were Beltons, were quite good paint.
Were they easy to get, Beltons?
A couple of shops, I think. A couple of car shops, Beltons. There was a shop in Holloway Road. I think they sold Beltons. But people like Hate used to go to Amsterdam and get this paint, Spava.
Big up Hate.
Big up Hate, yeah. And people used to, they used to, we used to go on missions out of London. So we'd call them plots. We'd have plots in, say, Maidenhead, or where they're a bit more clueless. They wouldn't think, oh, people are doing graffiti. We'd have to go out of London. So you'd bunk the train, go to Maidenhead, find the art shops and stuff, get loads and loads of paint. But then we became good at racking. So we'd be getting jeans or Walkmans and food and drink. And it was like a way of life, racking all day and then painting in the night.
I can't imagine you being criminally minded. I mean, and I say this to most graffiti writers that come on, because, you know, times change and things move. And obviously this is just one sample of your career trajectory.
Yeah, it was, I don't know, 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
But it's that adolescent time as well I can't imagine now running off a platform down the lines. I don't know if I could do that. But then it was just like nothing.
Do you even see it as part of your timeline at all?
Yeah, it was, because it's so influential.
You can picture yourself doing it, but you can't imagine doing it literally.
Yeah. I mean, at that age as well, you're wild. You take risks. You've got all that testosterone pumping through your body, and you're crazy.
What's the biggest risk you think you undertook that you even now you would say, well, if my kids did that, I would just... I mean, I know...
Just the train, the lines, trains, train lines, yards, hiding from trains. I mean, I remember we'd do track sides and the train would pull up because they'd saw us and stop there. And, yeah, just hotness like that kind of thing.
Wow, brazen.
Yeah, yeah. Running down the tracks, crossing tracks, in front of people, that kind of stuff. So it was mainly to do with the train lines were the riskiest thing. I didn't do like high spots or bridges, hanging off bridges and stuff like that. I never did that.
Yeah, it wasn't that kind of time, was it? There was a lot more...
It was more just based around trains or streets and tracksides. I guess that time, it's like you're kind of trying to find a way of expressing yourself, and you're just wild, and you're a teen, and
peer pressure.
You feel like you're invincible, I guess.
And there's a lot of other people around you doing the same thing as well. Right?
Yeah, yeah, and it's such a the buzz you get from it.
Mm. It was endorphin hit.
Yeah, yeah, it was a buzz. It was a rush.
And then I guess that's what separates you from, like you were saying, there's so many people that had tags back then.
Yeah.
But that's what really, if you had a drive and a slight level of ADHD or whatever, you know, you're going for it.
Well, I guess some people didn't do trains. Mm. Some people only didn't even get past tagging in their books. So it was a different, I guess the hierarchy was the people who did the trains were were the real deal.
Mm.
I mean, even now, for me, I stopped Graf in 88 and I never really followed it at all. So I didn't see the styles develop. I didn't see what came after. I didn't see all these killer writers who are still around now doing these amazing pieces. What really buzzes me is the illegality, the illegal side to it. The
whole subculture within that.
Yeah, and the bombing, and why are people taking these risks to do this stuff for no money? And the wildness and the kind of anti-authority side to it, the freedom. You don't get that doing a nice little wall on a Sunday. It's a different thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
So there were always two kinds of writers. There were the pieces, the people who were good style, and they were really good artists.
Mm.
But then there were the bombers who were just like people like 10 Foot who are still going.
Yeah, 10 Foot.
Who were just really, really getting their name everywhere.
Yeah. It's a classic technique. It's a classic style from a classic hero, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, so for me the people who could do both were the top writers.
Dangerous.
So if they were doing illegal stuff, trains, but they had style, they were the best.
Mm.
So it didn't matter how good your pieces were in your piece book or on a wall. You could take your whole day to do that on the wall. It was, how can you rock a train?
You
and even now it's like, I really get a buzz seeing stuff on trains, and like, it could be the most amazing, intricate, wild style on the wall, and it's like, yeah, whatever.
Yeah,
It doesn't buzz. It doesn't give me a buzz. It's like street art.
Yeah,
it's completely like.
But when you see it on a rolling train,
it's like, that energy.
Yeah,
and you know what's gone behind it. You know what you've had to do to get to that.
Well, you do. You do. But right out of this moment, do not try that at home, all right? You know, this is the guidance here. This is purely for storytelling purposes.
And it's like, and the punishment is so severe now here for trains. I know a lot of writers, I saw a couple of interviews and people were saying they go to Europe to do trains because... It's just impossible here. So that's even more respect for the people doing the trains.
Dangerous ways and levels, isn't it? You know.
Yeah.
The hotting up that maybe was installed at the start of graffiti as a journey. It's funny, isn't it, how authorities take that the opportunity to. It's almost like cruel to be kind levels of security. And if you breach it, if you get killed, it's your problem. It's like when you were saying at the start of it all, you know, trains would slow down and wait for you to just get and get out.
And like press the horn or whatever, right, when right next to us.
Because they don't want anything happening to you. Right, you know, maybe there's a different attitude now. It's protection of their property.
Well, and it's all about property ownership
and
control and a visible loss of control. So if they're seeing that their trains are being taken over by little vandals, it symbolises more crime or that they've lost control.
The broken window effect sort of.
Yeah. Yeah, I know some. I mean, even my ex was saying that her friend, you know, at Christmas when a load of writers did Oxford Circus, they did the actual stations.
Like rings bells.
Through COVID.
Yeah, rings bells.
They did a load of. They broke into Oxford Circus and they did all the platforms and everything.
Yeah.
And she was saying, oh God, through COVID, the crime must be going up and up because look at all this. It kind of, to normal people, that it symbolizes that. A lot of normal people. It's graffiti or tagging, or it symbolises that there's more crime, the crimes in the area, or crime is going up, that the authorities can't control it.
You're into the criminology side
that's
of things.
Broken windows theory.
It's the broken window
but there
thing.
Is a point to it, whether the punishments obviously don't work and the prevention measures work to an extent. You've got your CCTV.
Mm.
That kind of stuff, but the other argument is, well, it's just displaced somewhere else, so people will just, wherever they're trying to control it, it'll move somewhere else, kind of thing.
That's right.
Yeah, but yeah, that's all part of the criminology. Right. But London and the UK, especially, because of the governments and because of this country as a country, it's way more kind of harsh and punitive with the punishments, then maybe New York's the same now.
Yeah, it's gone that way.
It's just, I think it's just to show an image of the state in control,
yes,
isn't it?
Or
the authorities in control. We don't want to be seen to have lost control.
And do you think receptively that the graffiti writers or graph writers that do the more criminal based damage like that, do you think there is an upstanding of we can do it and get away with it, so, you know, fuck you? There is that, isn't there? It's almost like a tit for tat.
It's kind of a game, maybe, a little game that see if we can get away with it.
Yeah.
And I've got one up. Which we kind of had when we were teenagers or whatever. Mm. We were like that.
Mm.
We were like, fuck them. Yeah. Let's see how much damage we can do.
That's part of the course of graph, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. We were vandals, but we were artists as well, and vandals and loads of other things.
But it's also a class mentality, isn't it? That if you've got, and now I'm getting to this criminology thing because I know you're going into it, but it's like if you're from a class of a background, I won't say class, if you're in a background similar to myself, I'm sure similar to you, where you ain't getting heard. You're not about to go to Tate Modern. You're not about to go to Sotheby's with the stuff that you've got. There's got to be new routes into a creative arena, hasn't there?
Yeah, well, it doesn't even have to be creative. It's about being heard.
Yes.
So it's like,
yes,
graffiti is just saying, I'm alive.
Yeah.
I remember if you've seen Bad Meaning Good.
Yeah, hold tight, come on.
Well, Scam says it perfectly. Yeah. He goes, it's to say we exist. It's just we exist.
Yeah, yeah.
It's for people who are unheard, they call them the other.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
It's a voice of people of the unheard.
Mm-hmm.
So it's people, and usually young people aren't really heard.
Heard, yeah.
Yeah, and young people from different ethnic backgrounds or from poor backgrounds, even though a lot of writers were from middle class backgrounds, it was just a voice of being heard.
Solidarity as well, in a way.
Yeah, like a gang, I guess, being accepted from your peers, getting respect from people you respect that you don't get from your family or whatever, that kind of thing.
Mm.
Well, that's for me, it was anyway.
You were the first person to get bagged for graff.
Yeah, in 86.
In the country.
Well, to get sent to prison.
Madness.
Yeah,
86. Madness, I mean, you know what I mean? This is...
Which at the time, it was just, fuck, this, what's going on? But now, looking back on it, it's a bit of kudos.
It is. It's like, what was my dad's going to kill me has now become like, I'm kind of celebrated in a sense that I can actually say. I got a friend called Rob. He was the first person that got done for pulling off the Mercedes thing and using that as a Beastie Boys record. He was the first guy. He was actually in the newspaper and everything.
Oh, wow.
I mean, that's kind of another bit of kudos, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
Of that era.
I remember that.
Yeah. It was one of those times, wasn't it? What was it like to have been under that sort of pressure and spotlight?
What do you mean getting sent down?
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously my parents thought I was mental. They wanted me to see a psychiatrist because I wouldn't stop. I came out and kept doing it.
Mm.
But the actual place, it was me and Tilt, and we got sent to Hollisley Bay Detention Centre. So they called it Holiday Bay because it was the easiest detention centre. It was open. So you could escape, but everyone that escaped got caught.
Mm.
It was kind of on the coast in Ipswich. And you could smoke in there. It was the only detention centre you could smoke. But the worst part of that, of the DC, was the PE. So, you'd have to do circuit training every day.
Mate. So, you mean physical ed?
Yeah. So, hardcore. So, the first time you went in, the first day you did it, it was probably the most toughest thing strenuously physical thing I've ever done.
A boot camp? In a bag?
Yeah, like boot camp. So, you do a circuit. So it's different exercises for each going around, and you do one circuit. And the first time you do it is called the green circuit, the easiest circuit. By the end of your sentence, you're doing three times as much at red, so like much worse, and you're like this, I could do it no problem.
Ain't that something?
It's mad, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like, if you, and what I got out of that was like, if you can, if you put your mind to something, mind over matter, you can get through it.
Oh, fuck yeah.
Yeah, all you day. Can get through it. Yeah. Your body and your mind can withstand a lot, a lot. And the screws were like nasty to you. They'd hit people as they were going around because people were puking up and giving up and stuff like that.
Passing out.
Yeah.
Don't blame them.
So
that's an impact to the body.
So it was almost like this, if you can get through this, you can get through anything. So in a way, it was kind of good. Yeah, and I remember Tilt going, yeah, a bit of bird does you good. But
big
that
up
bird,
Tilt.
Not just 24-hour bang up, that wouldn't do you good.
Yeah, exactly.
But it almost gave me a bit of discipline as well. It's like self-discipline.
Yeah.
It was like the army. You get up, you have to fold your kit in a certain way, mm-mm, make the bed pack, stand to attention, like march everywhere, polish your boots, all that kind of stuff.
Shine your
yes,
shit.
Yes, sir. No, sir. Everyone's heads were shaved as they went in.
Really?
It was proper, like, take away any individuality. So you were
and
all
rebuild
a
you.
Number.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, yeah, and kind of break, try and break you so you come out a more disciplined person. But it had the opposite effect to most people.
What did
they came out and reoffended.
Really?
So it never worked. So they banned it because the short, sharp shock, it was called...
Mm.
Most people would reoffend afterwards. It didn't.
You kind of built them up to be even bigger and better than before.
You could run away.
Yeah, you could run away this time.
Yeah. So it was. Yeah, I mean, looking back on it, I kind of thought there was something good I got out of it, the self discipline and knowing that you can get through shit. But it was pointless in a deterrent. It had no deterrent effect.
Mm.
Or it didn't work. So we after that, I came out and did it even worse, like just went wild.
For how long, though? For another, what, 2 years?
A couple of years, yeah. So that was 86, so till 88, as coma. That was when I really kind
went
of...
Went in.
Yeah, as coma.
Resistance was off, you were going for it. Like
it was almost like I need... They made me... the authorities and the state made me more resentful and angry towards them by doing that, by sending... Mm. Us to prison and putting you through this shit. Mm. It's like they created these little army warriors to come back out and fucking give it to them.
Yeah, exactly. I think as a graph writer, the one thing that you can credit yourself for is that you've been pretty nimble at Krypton Factor. And if you're able to be shown the ropes of how to do things in your boot camp in it, and then you've got all these, you're ready to roll, aren't you?
Yeah.
Do you think it's a common trait that... people that offend, and again, sticking to the criminology side of things.
That's good.
People that offend, is it in their DNA to reoffend? Is there something more deeper and is there a more deeper element working inside that, bereavement, family?
Well, I guess it all depends on the individual, but most people who are in prison are from the poorer backgrounds or have mental illness.
Mm.
So, or have fucked up lives.
Yeah.
So that's kind of says it. It's like you don't really get the privileged, well-educated middle classes going to prison. But some of them are just as criminal.
Just you know what I mean?
Like, but apart, unless they get done for fraud or something like that.
Yeah.
But there's just, it's what they say... The rich get richer and the poor get prison.
Because they just can't facilitate. Poorer people cannot be seen by the doctor as immediate as maybe, that the higher classes can. Things like that.
Right? And there's less help for them, or they've got more troubled backgrounds, or drugs play a part.
Mm.
It's definitely a bit of nature-nurture thing.
Mm.
A bit of both.
Mm.
There are people, so you've got, say... brothers in a family, one of them ends up going to prison, the other one doesn't, and then they say, well, if he can do it, why doesn't he do it? So there are differences in biological differences that might maybe make people commit crime more than others, but most of all it's your environment and what you've got around you, what's going on in your life, your family upbringing, people you're hanging out with, that kind of stuff. It's loads of different things.
It's a real
And what do you say is crime? I mean, yeah, what was crime here? Say smoking in a public place wasn't a crime, I don't know, 20 years ago. Yeah. Now it is. Drinking on the bloody tube is now a crime or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And it never used to be.
Wearing a mask, things like that.
Yeah, so there's different crimes. The nature of crime changes depending in what the time and the place as well.
As a criminologist, do you think it's fair to say that people that have been tried for a crime that now could be seen as okay, do you think it's fair that they should be still inside for the thing that they commit? Like, for instance, decriminalizing weed, for instance, in the States.
Yeah, a lot of people have gone in for that.
Like, a lot of people have gone in. Do you it should be only fair that they get released, surely.
Of course. And it's America's really different, though, to here. It just, it's all depends on the state.
Mm.
So each state has its own laws. So in one state, weed could be decriminalized. The other state, you could get sent to prison for it. That's how varied it is.
Bonkers,
isn't
it?
It's just weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
But there's no way, of course not. You shouldn't, with certain things that most people would think aren't damaging to other people or morally, should be fine. I mean, they put way too many people in prison in this country and in America that shouldn't be. But it's all political. It's all like,
money.
With the private ones, but it's about vote winning. So the government need to be shown that they're tough on crime, because the public want that, and the media kind of fuel that, and so it's like this vicious circle.
It's self-serving to people that have, you know, that can invest money into those systems that can keep people in jail as well.
Yeah, that's it's a lot worse in America, I think, that the private prisons and the prison industrial complex. But here, it's not about stopping crime or making society better. It's about how do we get votes, how do we get elected. It's like the public don't know any. The public just get what they're fed from the media. So the media needs to sell or get likes or sell papers or whatever. So they're gonna make out crime is bad, these people are bad, these people, the public are gonna believe it. And so the government need the public's vote, so that the government are going to be tough, even though it doesn't work. It might not work. So the whole thing is just—it's not real. It's just all about power.
Power.
Yeah, rather than making society better or stopping crime. But on the good thing, crime has come down for the last 20 years, in the whole of the Western world.
It's funny you say that,
it's come down.
I've noticed, I think, I can't remember what program it was I watched, but something similar to this is like, I think it's because it's exercised that people post and retweet and share content, and you see all these crazy, horrible things that are happening, but it is going down, isn't it?
It's just more documented, yeah. So throughout the Western world, crime has been going down. But I think through COVID, it started to go up again. Like, I saw a program about the Bronx in New York and how there's so many more people doing heroin. The crime has just gone
shut
a lot
up.
Higher. That was just the last year, though, couple of years because of COVID. But before that, and no one knows why. No one knows why. There's loads of different theories, like things like even like abortion have since. So before abortion, there might have been a lot more unwanted kids who'd go off the rails and all this kind of stuff. But now, and even things like lead in petrol, their theories of since they took the lead out of petrol, crime has gone down.
Really?
Yeah. But
like
I think the
butterfly effect almost.
Yeah, but I think it's to do with people have just become a bit more better off materially, generally everywhere.
But the focus is more on the new age materials and phones and shit like that. I guess there's a lot more distraction.
More of a distraction of consuming on your phone, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's the adult pacifier. It's like you're just pacified.
Yeah, yeah. Or the young person's babysitter.
Yeah.
Give me the iPad, quick. But we are. We're breeding people into this, aren't we?
But, yeah, that's a whole other thing But with the phone now, you don't need... Everyone is policing each other.
That's right. Doing the job for them.
Yeah, so when anything happens, you know, everyone's out of that with their phones.
Yeah.
Like, filming it all.
Yeah.
It's like, you don't need CCTV. Now everyone is so like policing each other, that police we're state. All controlling our behaviour because yeah. we know someone could film us and that. That's how that's yeah. that was predicted by this French guy Foucault.
For real?
Foucault is a like a French philosopher.
How do you spell that?
Foucault.
Let's check with Michel Foucault. Let's check with Ballsy. Let's check with Ballsy.
No, getting into a bit of Foucault on yeah, the podcast.
Come on, I mean, this is very rare that we getting all these words today.
That there'd be different little forms of controlling people that would make us affect our behaviour, so we'd be control. Everyone would be controlling themselves because. Have you heard of the Panopticon?
Talk to me.
So the Panopticon was this tower. It was originally just a tower for a prison where the guard at the top could see how the prison was built in such a way around the tower that the guard at all times could see in everyone's cell. So when you know you're being watched, you're going to adjust your behaviour. So
lab rats.
Yeah. So he didn't need to do anything. Everyone just controlled their own behaviour because they know they were being watched all the time.
So it's a psychological effect of like them knowing that.
So that has in this now in this society, you can see it with the CCTV everywhere, with things like open plan offices, the trains, so you can walk all the way through. Everyone can see everything, so you're more wary of, you know, right, I can't do anything
space
wrong because someone might see me.
Wow.
So that's where we're heading. That's where we've got. Mobile phones are just another form of that. That's like the ultimate form.
You're all snitches. Every one of us.
Filming everyone else. Yeah. It's like, you don't need police.
No. We're all snitches. You know what I mean? All of a sudden, it's like, what are you doing without a mask? It's like that silly kind of...
So it's kind of heading towards like George Orwell.
Yeah,
shit.
For sure. Demolition Man.
Unless people do something about it.
Yeah.
But everyone just is so distracted by their bloody phones. Yeah. No one gives a shit.
Bro, I looked in the back end of my Instagram, and that's just one platform, and I saw the hours in which I was on a day. Apparently I do at the moment, I'm aiming to change, an hour and 56.
On the phone?
On Instagram.
That's probably,
alone.
On Instagram
on
alone.
Just Instagram. That might be an average.
People probably do much more. You reckon? Yeah, but... obviously, it's good and bad with the Instagram, with the graffiti. I think Instagram's got a lot to do with the everyone wanting to look at the old graph photos and the graffiti thing. There are a lot of old writers who've got Instagram accounts, people posting up old stuff. And it's good for culture or looking at old stuff.
Yeah.
But then you got that whole narcissistic selfie crap that... with the DJs all just DJing behind, dancing behind the decks and stuff, where they just for likes kind of thing. Yeah. That's the bullshit side of it.
Yeah, but substance has suddenly disappeared. It's not. It's not really about that.
Yeah, it's not about quality or it's about look at me.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. And again, back to
and
that
self-serving
sort of thing, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's about the self rather than a culture or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's true, and you know, moving on actually to your career as the bona fide path that kind of set precedence from the graph, right? That you went into the music.
Well, because of getting caught and then knowing I was going to get sent to prison again, I kind of stopped anyway. I thought, I can't carry on illegally.
Mm. But how old were you around that time? What was the age?
20.
Still young. Still at home, probably.
I think, still living at home, yeah.
All those things.
So my last piece was in 8 years. Yeah, I was 20.
Wow.
So I kind of gradually came to a point where I lost interest or I didn't want to do anything illegally. So I couldn't really, I didn't want to do walls.
Because you went against the, you know, what you
were into. Yeah, exactly. It wasn't. I wasn't a particularly good style. It took me 3 years to get good, and that was the best bit. The journey of getting to a stage where I'm actually got good style now. Once I got good style, that was it. I gave up
because you'd already got that's it.
It was loads of factors because I didn't want to get caught, because I couldn't do trains again, and. And because Acid House came along as well. So it was like I took an ecstasy in 88, and then you never, no looking back.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. No,
the graffiti got dark as well. So not only were we getting robbed by Tape Tone, but some writers were robbing other writers, and there was a lot of crime going on in like 87, 88. I remember I went to the Public Enemy concert in Hammersmith and got robbed there in the concert.
Yeah, I remember this so, been told before.
And I know that people were steaming the trains afterwards. Yep. So it just got not dark. Mm. Acid House came along. Everyone was peace and love, hugging you, and it was all love. That was all hate. So
bye, hip hop. See you later.
So, but after Public Enemy, I didn't really listen to hip hop anymore. I stopped listening to hip hop.
Just was like because of the attitude in the scene, you felt it was just too not
because I'd moved into this acid house scene, and it was ecstasy and dance music, and that once you take an ecstasy and you listen to dance music. For me, anyway, I was hooked on the music. It would kind of goes hand in hand. It was like that 120 BPM, four to the floor, and you just get in a groove, and it all kind of works with the E.
Totally. Don't think it don't get you, because like I'm as hip hop as the rest of some of you lot, and I swear to God, I've been to raves of a time where I really couldn't have seen myself doing it, and I'm like, yo, it's all an environment thing. You've got to be in it.
Yeah, yeah. Mad. If you're in it and you're on the drugs with everyone else, it's spiritual.
Total game changer.
Yeah. It's almost like religious. You're having a spiritual experience. When everyone's coming together, all on the same buzz, under the same, with the DJ's a bit like a shaman type thing. He's performing and you're all together. It is religious, I guess.
It's a religious movement.
And so when that, you... There's no turning back from that at that age. And I was into music anyway. So I kind of channeled that creative energy towards music instead of graph. So I started buying records. I got a job when I came out of prison as a messenger. So I had a wage every Friday. So I'd go to Red Records. It was in Beak Street in Soho.
Yeah.
And so I'd go there every Friday, buy up records. I'd take trips to New York to get records.
What's a messenger, though? What is a messenger?
Just a foot messenger delivering things.
That's so cold.
So, you know, like bike messengers or cycle couriers.
Yeah.
So it was just a foot one. So it,
stop it.
So it was a printing company in Victoria, and most of their clients were architects. So I'd have to, twice a day or sometimes in between, I take the prints that they do, these huge prints for architects, to the architects, pick up what the next lot they want, take it back. So that was just that walking around all day.
Yeah.
So I just listen to music all day on a Walkman and just walk around all day.
That's bonkers.
A foot messenger.
I'd never even have heard of it before. This is like,
I don't know if they have them anymore.
No. There's a story I've heard about the old grey whistle test. Now, the thing behind Old Grey Whistle Test is, of course, the programme that we know as the BBC. But back in the day, a lot of the houses of music in the industry was in Soho. And what they used to do, the producers of the music, they used to open the windows in the morning and pump out the music really loud for people to hear. Old Greys were old soldiers from war that were too old to go to normal jobs, so they became posties.
Okay.
And they were called Old Greys. And they used to walk around Soho. And what they would do is they'd hear the music. And if you hear the Old Grey whistle, off he goes. It's the Old Grey whistle test. Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
So when you were talking about the messenger, that I thought, it reminded me of that. You know,
Old
like,
Grey whistle test.
Yeah. Of that era of like messengers and sending and, you know, that kind of era of music and shit. Crazy.
Basically, it was just a courier, but on foot.
Yeah.
So I'd just deliver things and pick things up.
So sick.
But it gave me a chance to just listen to music all day walking around. So it kind of, I got into buying music every Friday with my wages or whatever, getting two decks and then DJing from there.
So it was to facilitate the bigger idea of like getting out there and DJing.
Yeah. I mean, I started DJing in 89 straight away. Got my first gig at a place called The Crazy Club, which was at Busby's on Tottenham Court Road. It's no longer there. And it was on a Sunday in the daytime. So people would be going out raving all night and then they'd carry on coming to this place. It was like an after hours, but they started
definitely
in the daytime.
Era, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Definitely the rave era.
So I got my first gig there, and then the Crazy Club did, they did the Astoria, they took over the Astoria on a Saturday night. So I used to play in the bar. I never played in the main room. So in the main room would be people like Fabio and Groove Rider, Ray Keith, those guys. Before drum and bass, though. So they'd be playing kind of hardcore.
Yeah.
Maybe some harder house stuff.
Mm.
And I'd play in the back room. So that was my first kind of gigs. And
wow.
Then I'd do the odd gig here and there. There was another club called Sign of the Times, which was more fashion. Fiona, she had a shop in Kensington Market, no longer there, mm-hmm. which was like a place where punks, goths, rockers, all these different youth cultures could go and buy clothes and stuff like that.
Wicked.
Yeah,
it's not there anymore. Yeah, that sucks. Yeah.
So I used to sell my tapes, disco tapes, that I got from New York there. And so she started giving me, she used to put on parties. And she gave me a few gigs at her parties during the 90s. And then I wasn't DJing regularly, though.
Mm.
It wasn't until I did my first record, and that's when it all started kicking off as a career, I guess.
That's some interesting, having Steam on, big up to you, obviously Drax, and a few others of the time,
yeah,
they cite that era, like you're saying, the mixtape culture, the rave, the acid house, that this was a real kind of transitional thing for a lot of writers. It's almost like they put the cans down and all of a sudden, like, do you think they recognised you as being that one of the go-to people of the time that was actually a writer as well, you know, that you were in the scene? Or did you keep your...
Yeah, it was separate, really.
Really?
I know, because I didn't really hang out with any writers that much then. Mm. Casby, me and Casby are still into music, a lot of music.
Mm.
So we do re-edits, we've put stuff out, and
sick.
We always play music to each other.
Mm.
So it's kind of good. We've got like similar tastes.
Mm.
But no other writers were into that. I know I saw Drax had posted something up about a piece he did around the Acid House era.
Mm-hmm.
And I know Fuel likes acid, and a lot of the Rev, obviously, rest in peace, Rev.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Harvey. So it's Harvey, Chocky, and Rev.
You're throwing names right now.
They were kind of the writers who were doing like good parties.
Yeah,
I went to. I think they were called the Bash Street Kids parties. Some of them. Then they became Tonka.
Comments below. You know what we're doing here.
Yeah. So there were Bash Street Kids. Drax was probably part of that, involved with all that stuff.
Wow.
He'd have to correct me, but Harvey, Chocky and Rev would be Harvey wasn't really a writer, but Chocky and Rev were. And they would put in on parties, so I would go now and again to hear them. But for me, Harvey was my favorite DJ. He'd be cutting up breaks, and then he'd got into disco and then house, and to this day he is still the Don. He's a superstar DJ now.
Boy.
But he still always plays music that no one else has got.
That's the whole point,
yeah,
isn't it?
And good luck to him. He's done really well.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got that kind of attitude and he's got charisma and all that. So he's done. Mm. He's like a superstar now.
Yeah.
I used to hear him play cutting up bloody breaks.
I love that. And yeah. I love that you say Fabio and Groove Rider were like hardcore rave, because we forget about these.
They played house.
Yeah.
So I've got a tape from Kiss FM when Fabio and Groove Rider were playing the house.
Yeah. I mean, old tapes back in the day with the flyers that were actually the inlay cards and shit. That was how I used to consume that stuff. And I remember like DJ Psy and Rat Pack. But then there was Jumpin' Jack Frost, there was Shy FX, there was
those guys,
Fabio and Groove
LTJ
Rider.
Bookham, yeah. Ray Keith, those guys.
But it went on that drum and bass thing like they became.
It was hardcore and jungle, maybe proto jungle. So like Belgian R&S stuff, some of the darker New York things.
Yeah.
Breakbeat. Yeah. That breakbeat at house tempo.
Mm. Were you into that?
I hated that stuff, actually.
Did you? You hated it?
I was more into the trendy kind of Italian house stuff and New York.
More jackier stuff.
Yeah, a bit more American and not really the British stuff. Mm. I mean, I like the early house. I actually put a compilation out of early UK house stuff and acid on Strut, which people like. I used to really like
Strut, that's Evil, awesome.
Evil Eddie Richards, yeah. Kid Bachelor, Harvey, Weatherall, Andrew Weatherall. These were my favourite DJs. And they played like just quality underground music, kind of housier stuff. They weren't really playing the hardcore or the jungle.
No, it was a mood. It was a mood, wasn't it?
Yeah, I guess it kind of branched off. A lot of DJs just went down the housier route. And then there was the jungle and drum, which became drum and bass.
Yeah.
So it was like two different things. And I went down the house, more into the house stuff. I guess there weren't really, I wasn't really known as a writer. I'd left all that behind.
Yeah.
It was almost like, I'm just into this now. I couldn't really give a shit about that.
Yeah.
It's only now that I'm looking back on
that. It's because you get knocks on the doors like this from me and fucking 521 and everyone. It's, hello! Big up F24 as well. I might just say, because obviously there is a creative process to production and one in which you are constantly in the mix with even now.
I still make music.
You're still making music. This is what you're doing. Talk to us about that and talk to us about your processes and how that relates in the more general sense of creativity.
Right. Well, it is like doing a piece. It's with the way I make music is I start off with samples.
Mm.
So it could be drums from this disco track and a bass line from something else. I might end up replaying it, but that's just the sketches, I guess, the sketch.
Mm.
It's almost like, that's one colour, that's another colour, that's another colour. How to get, cold. How it all comes together.
Yeah.
So just create the same, similar process, but just with music instead of painting. And I get more of a, I don't know, I get a buzz actually making music. It's like kind of the same that I used to get with Graf. But really? I'll just be at home on my own making
endorphin
stuff.
Endorphin hits and that sort.
And you're in the zone.
Yeah.
You're in the zone. And you're creating something and you're just totally into it in that moment and nothing else matters. And it's almost like, yeah. Obviously, sometimes every producer I speak to says, yeah, there's a process that you go through. It's like, wow, this is the best tune ever that I'm making. You're so in love with it.
Mm.
You come back to it a few days later and go, oh, I don't know about that.
That's a bad one-night stand, wasn't it?
I'm a bit... Or that bit is good. That bit's shit. Get rid of that. Get rid of that. Keep that. So you're always changing. So that's how I am.
Even
up to now, I'm like, is this any good? I don't know. It sounded good at the time.
But you're meditating. When you're doing stuff,
it's almost like meditation. When you're actually make in the zone, make in that creative process, nothing else matters,
Time flies.
You're just so into that moment, and you're creating something as well, and that was like painting a train. Obviously, you had to be more aware of police and stuff.
But there is this frontal cortex. Okay, here's the science bit. Spice alert! But there is a frontal cortex thing with creativity. People, Beatles mania, how girls can go absolutely nuts over musicians and music.
Right.
And this is a real thing, isn't it? Because when you're serving music or serving art to people, it's so immediate. The impact, it's like it stains your head.
It's physical and emotional all at once. You can feel it.
Yeah.
Like women seem to like bass.
Yeah,
I don't know what it is.
Yeah, yeah.
It gets women moving, kind of thing.
Wind.
And I don't know, the vibrations that make music connect with you somehow, that it can make you feel different ways. Kind of like music can make you feel happy, sad, like uplifting, whatever.
That's
energy.
Right. And you're in the now. They're in the now with you. Who made it? We're all, especially live, of course, and in clubland.
Yeah.
We're all on the same vibe.
Yeah. And it's invisible. It's magic, people say. Yeah. It could be seen as that. And the reason I like DJing is connecting with people more than... I like making music, being in that zone, but DJing I'm probably better at, and I get more of a buzz even, but what's seeing the interaction with the people.
For sure.
Yeah. 100%. So it's like you get a buzz seeing them getting a buzz, yeah, kind of thing. It's like, wow. Mm. But yeah.
Mm. No, that's a very good point. Being present. I think that's the biggest fear for the powers that be. Music, I mean, just alluding back to the clash of its time, politically charged music. That's like, yeah, and also movement, big cult movements like the Acid House era and even today, drill. Like, that's the biggest threat to government, because these are things that are uncontrollable. They're yeah, personal, aren't they?
And the young people will always want that, yeah, unless we live in this extreme controlled state where they get rid of it.
Mm.
But it's becoming more and more controlled. This probably isn't deliberate, but because of COVID, the last gig I did, I had to do the lateral flow test, take a photo of it with next to photo ID, and then show the photo with the date on it to prove that it was me. Anyone on the guest list had to send all their emails. It took away any spontaneity,
fun,
or fun.
Yeah.
And then you're getting, yeah, it like strip search, well, practically in there. It was so controlled. And it's like, I hope clubs don't go that way. But even if they do, I think there will still be an underground. There will still be people who want to have fun on their own terms.
Yeah.
And luckily, we could probably still get away with it. There are little cheeky little venues here and there where you get your own sound system, bring your own bar, have your own little parties.
Yeah, we love that.
It might go back to that because everything is becoming so strict and controlled. But young people will always, I mean, since whatever, rock
Criminal
and roll.
Criminal Justice Bill didn't have much of an effect at the time. It's just they fought through it. They fought, carried on fighting, didn't they?
Yeah. Young people always want to have a party. And I think this country as well, there's that culture of caning it. Like, whether it's drinking, doing ease, whatever. Yeah. But there's that culture of really love, that hedonistic culture in this country that, I don't know, it's hard. Let's hope it stays.
Yeah. Let's hope. Well, as you were talking, it just occurred to me that, and as a contender now, as somebody that's constantly putting out music and constantly expressing himself, you've been a part of the UK street culture scene from the beginning.
Right.
I mean, guess, you know what I mean? From your history points when you were younger that you mentioned.
Yeah, to
now.
Well, I guess since the mid-80s through Graf and then into the rave culture.
Yeah.
Even though I wasn't a big DJ during the rave culture, I was still going to raves and DJing now and again. I wasn't putting music out.
Mm.
And then through the late 90s, I did my first track under the name Bronx Dogs with my mate Paul. But it was almost like it was influenced by hip-hop, but not rap. So we used to listen to the Death Mix, the Bambaataa, Jazzy J.
Yeah.
Death Mix with the MCs going, it's Jazzy J. And we'd analyze that and see it and found out every single break that Jazzy J used. And so we sampled the MC going, it's Jazzy. And then used all the breaks. There was a break by Edwin Starr that was like the main break going through the track. That was our first track under the name Bronx Dogs.
No way.
Yeah. So it was almost like a homage back to hip hop, but it was played in the dance clubs.
That's crazy.
Harvey actually broke it. So DJ Harvey was the first one to play it, and then people were going mad over it.
See, they retraced the elements of the song. Before YouTube, ladies and gentlemen, this is something that you literally went
in 1997.
Find them through ear.
Yeah, exactly.
Mad.
So we copied what Jazzy J had done. We got them in, we just used the same breaks. We called it Tribute to Jazzy J.
Mm-hmm.
And then it kind of crossed. It was played in a lot of those B-boy things, so the hip-hop guys got into
embraced
it, the breakers
it, yeah.
But then at the same time in the dance clubs, so even in house and disco-y, new disco clubs. And at that time, there was that big beat kind of scene, the late 90s. London was buzzing.
Hold tight, Derek DeLarge, my boy.
Big up Derek.
Come on, we can't say big beat and not say his name.
Yeah, well, Derek always raves about that.
Yeah, totally.
So it's like we kind of went back to our hip-hop roots, and then I used my... Paul was from a hip-hop background. I was from more house background musically. And then we came together, and that was the first time I put something out. And that's when the DJing started to take off, really. And I've been making music since. So after that, I did stuff with my friend Neil under the name Padded Cell. And it was...
Dude, I remember this, yeah.
So it was a lot darker.
Yeah.
So we took samples from Disco Breaks.
Yeah.
Disco samples, but then played like kind of almost like Italian horror style synths,
so sick,
over the top, for a label called DC Recordings, which were big from Grove. They were from Grove, Labatt Grove.
From Grove?
Yeah. Jonathan, Depth Charge.
Depth Charge, yeah.
He was one of the first DJs before I was DJing. So he DJed with Scam's Lot, with Crew and those guys.
That's
under
right.
Grim Death,
hold
I
tight,
think.
Crew, hold tight, yeah.
And Nutriment as well was one of those big DJs back then.
My mind is blown.
There
right
was
now.
A club called Rockbox that he used to do.
Yeah.
That Scam was the one, I guess, took us to a few of those things. One of them was on a rooftop.
Scam relays a lot of this in his podcast. So, I'm just drawing dots here. This is like
all mad. All of that, I guess, influence is all part of my cultural DNA.
Hip-hop is in it.
It's hip-hop's in it, even though I wasn't really into music rap.
Yeah.
Afterwards, and I don't know anything about hip-hop, 90s hip-hop. Mm. I know the big names, Pete Rock, Premier, that kind of thing, but I didn't follow it or listen to it.
And the same with Graf, isn't it? You
and
really
Graf,
disconnect.
Yeah, I have no idea until now. I missed all the DDS on the trains, those guys. Mm. I just didn't follow it. I didn't even see much of it. I didn't get into the hip hop side of it, as in like the music and a lot of the hip hop and writers got into drum and bass because it was like British hip hop, UK hip hop,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah,
I just went more into the house and techno,
international kind of movement in music, house music,
big rave culture and electronic music.
What's your discography? Because for those of
there's
you,
so
that,
much.
Yeah, I know. We're gonna have to put a link, aren't we? We're gonna put a link of all the. From then to now.
It's on Discogs. So if you go to discogs.com, just type in Richard Sen, you'll see the discography.
Madness, yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's quite a lot. I have remixed people like Sugar Hill Gang, Jungle Brothers, Sizzler, and then obviously Brian, and then more kind of other pop artists, Brian Ferry, John Grant, and then housier stuff or more disco LCD sound system.
Heavy.
Yeah. So I've done a lot. Yeah. And I'm still putting music
still doing it
under my own name.
That's the exciting bit.
But yeah, it's just that creative thing is similar to Graf, and it all ties in with
you're in it. That's you. Your testament to somebody that can morph your creative output and still hold true to, like you say, that the blueprint of what you feel the creative process is.
Right.
I guess so. When you said about the components, like the ingredients that make it, like the outline is that, that's what I'm kind of getting at. Is
it's still the same
the principles.
Process. Yeah. And like with the DJing now though, in London, everyone's a DJ. Mm. It's like everyone you meet, I'm DJing. And there are so many more people DJing now. And I don't know whether they've got that genuine respect for what's come before, for the history. Mm. I've always been into learning about the history.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a culture, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's a cultural thing.
Mm.
There are a lot of DJs now, more than before probably, because of social media, who just want to get as famous as they can, as fast as they can.
TikTok that shit quick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a shame. And it's just saturated with all these, like, wannabes.
Mm.
But what can you do?
Well, that's what we're here to do.
But there are still people who are genuinely into quality and the history and the culture.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Which is what you're doing, yeah.
Yeah, man, it's what it's all about on here, man. And yeah. For those of you that are just being introduced to Richard Acoma, then, you know, there's a lot more out there to get involved. I will put all the links and everything in. There is another website as well that you alerted me to that you've set up.
Well, I've set up an Instagram page just called 1980s London Train Graffiti.
Yeah.
And that's just dedicated to the 80s. So it's photos of pieces on trains and then of some writers as well.
There you
some
go.
Of the writers.
New platform alert.
But I haven't posted up for months, so maybe I'm basically nicking stuff from everyone's page and from Rockin' the City and from Facebook and whoever sends me stuff to put it on there. It's not about any gaining anything out of it. It's just like to document it as a train scene.
Yeah,
so there's
right.
no walls. No
big,
walls.
Big up
it.
Everyone. To big up the fact checker, massive, the awesome B-Boy Documents as well. That's been
B-Boy
holding
Documents.
That,
yeah, he's sent me some stuff.
Yeah, man, serious business. And big up Score as well for all the work that he puts in.
Yeah,
that level
Score.
As well. Wow,
it's still going strong.
Yeah,
yeah, Kilo.
Yeah,
big up Kilo.
Absolutely. Everybody that's like representing the scene and getting deep into it. You know, documenting all these important. You know.
Yeah,
runs.
And I think now's the time, isn't it, that people are. Starting to get interested because there's been enough time and the 80s are seen as cool.
Mm.
But what I heard something the other day, from now looking back to the 80s is like when you're in the 80s looking back to the 40s. Jesus.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah.
God forbid anybody that's listening to this in 2030. What the fuck are we thinking? What were they thinking? Doing this
like,
stuff on walls and shit, doing on
it's
trains?
Like talking about the war
or something. Yeah. During the war. Well, it's been a pleasure talking about
it's
the
been,
war with you, my brother.
Soldiers.
Soldier. Hold tight, soldier. Richard Singh, Coma inside the place. Thank you so
Thanks,
much, brother. Oh, that was brilliant.
It was good fun.
That was a lot of fun. Ladies and gentlemen, you know what we're doing here. Sharing is caring. And if you ain't sharing, you're in the wrong fucking voice, all right? We're out like he was out of fashion, okay? Stay looking after each other. Don't talk to anyone I wouldn't. We're out like that. Cheers, Rich.
Cheers.
Peace.